And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when different segments of the American populace, of the voting public, different segments are trying to move us back into the past in very different ways. There's a group today that has announced its desire to disrupt the Democratic National Convention coming up in August. Really? Yeah, really. This is an attempt to go back to Chicago of 1968. There is also a group of people who gathered at the White House in a desire to take us back not to August of 1968, but to take us back to June of 1968. That was the time of the assassination of Robert Kennedy, his family. And in fact, the extended Kennedy family has made a passionate announcement, and it's a passionate announcement about avoiding mistakes of the more recent past for people on the extreme left, mistakes as in 2000 or as in 2016. We will get to that Kennedy family voice coming up. We'll also be speaking to the battle in the House of Representatives with Mike Johnson now taking what I believe, and I was gratified to see that Daniel Henninger of the Wall Street Journal agrees with me, is a courageous stand by the Speaker of the House, who is far exceeding the expectations of an always cynical public. I mean, cynical because the House of Representatives have been such a mess. Could he possibly get things together for aid to Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, and for the United States defense system and for border security? Get all of that together and somehow survive as Speaker, defeating the attacks of folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene. We will get to that. Okay, first of all, this new announcement, and it's a Dateline Chicago, in a room full of 450 far left activists, a leader with the Freedom Road Socialist Organization kicks off a chant. Protest is a right, not just for the rich and white. Protest is a right, not just for the rich and white. Oh, great. Okay. Joe Ios Baker said, have you heard that the Democratic National Convention is coming to Chicago? Are we going to let them come here without a protest? This is Chicago, GD it. We've got to give them a 1968 kind of welcome. I was there in Chicago in 1968 briefly. And it was horrible and ugly and really one of the worst episodes of recent history. There were literally hundreds of people who were injured. There were police officers who were injured. There were battles between police and demonstrators. And what were they demonstrating about? They were demonstrating against the Democratic Party, and they actually played a role in electing Richard Nixon, who was the Republican candidate. And they write here in background, in 1968, the Democratic Convention in Chicago was a bloodbath with 600 arrests in just one of the street battles that were broadcast all over the world. And the group that met here in the local headquarters of the Teamsters Union wants to repeat history when Joe Biden is named the presidential nominee at the DNC this August. They oppose the president they call Genocide Joe for backing Israel in its war against Hamas. This is a complicated issue, and it's one of those things, reading about this and hearing some of the chants and the arguments on by these extreme lefties and attacking Biden as Genocide Joe. Could that possibly help him? I think it could. when you have enemies and critics who are so loathsome and despicable and anti-American, frankly, and yes, of course, anti-Semitic, that among the majority of Americans who I think are good and decent and patriotic people, that could make you think twice about voting against Joe Biden. Because, look, I think you can criticize Joe Biden from a pro-Israel perspective. I mean, this whole idea of Israel should take the win, and that the Biden statement that if Israel responds or retaliates against that mass attack by Iran, that they'll have to go it alone, that's not so appealing. But when Genocide Joe, in quotes, is standing up against these radicals, frankly, he looks downright heroic by comparison. And at a moment of deep-seated anti-Semitism, and there was a report earlier this week that is stunning, actually, about the increase in anti-Semitism. And on Tuesday of this week, the ADL released, that's the Anti-Defamation League, its audit for 2023. It recorded 8,873 anti-Semitic incidents in the United States, a 140% increase over 2022, and a tenfold increase over a decade ago. The numbers include 161 physical assaults. That's nearly one every other day. 2,177 acts of vandalism, and 1,000 bomb threats against synagogues and other Jewish institutions. That compared with 91 bomb threats for 2022. In other words, more than 10 times as many. Jewish cemeteries were desecrated 13 times last year, up from 4 times the year before. Much of the increase came after Hamas's massacre in Israel on October 7th, and the Anti-Defamation League changed its methodology. But even without the methodology changes, the ADL would still have recorded 7,523 anti-Semitic incidents last year. What do some of those incidents look like? The report offers dozens of examples. In February 2023, a man shot two Jewish men as they were leaving a synagogue. In May, swastikas made of feces were smeared in a residence hall bathroom in the University of California, San Diego. In July, a group of about 20 people assaulted three Jewish teenagers at New York's Rockaway Beach after noticing that one of them was wearing a Star of David. In October, Gemma DeCristo, a professor in American Studies at University of California, Davis, threatened, quote, Zionist journalists. They have houses with addresses, kids in school, she wrote, before signing off with a knife, a hatchet, and blood emojis. This is amazing stuff. Anti-Semitism can be difficult to define, a fact that has long offered anti-Semites an opportunity to hide their prejudice behind terminology. But as Justice Potter Stewart once said about pornography, I know it when I see it. So it could be said about hatred of Jews. To see it in America today, you don't have to look very far. And the idea of pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas demonstrations in the streets of Chicago at the time of the Democratic Convention, that's something to await. We're also awaiting the outcome in Congress, where they're supposed to vote over the weekend, I believe, on the final decision on funding aid to Ukraine. We'll talk about that in the context with Stephen Newcomb of Axios, who's right on top of the story. We'll be right back.
The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, there is a great deal of excitement, trepidation, horror, and impassioned feeling concerning decisions that are going to be made in the House of Representatives, which is so closely divided. I believe the Republicans now have an operative advantage in the House of Representatives of a single vote. And events of the weekend are going to be very fateful, decide the future for the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, and also for the future of U.S. foreign aid for Israel and for Ukraine and for the Indo-Pacific. We're pleased to welcome to the show Stephen Newcomb, who is a political reporter for Axios. He covers Congress. And in terms of the latest details, are they scheduled to actually finally have a vote that would include the aid that Ukraine so desperately needs? That's supposed to happen before Saturday night. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, there's there's a couple of procedural hurdles that still need to get over. You mentioned the Republicans sort of slim, ultra-thin majority in the House right now. And the way that the House moves and operates is they have to pass this thing called a rule before they can move forward with debate and a vote on a bill. And now the problem is usually, historically, those rules are voted along on party lines, but there's conservatives who are not happy with this bill and these bills, and they are threatening to not vote for the rule. So that's going to require Democrats to go across the line and help out Speaker Mike Johnson vote for this rule to get this package to the floor. Now, there is expectation that that's going to happen. But again, that is it's not unprecedented, but it is a rare move. And that still has to happen before they can move on to debate and a vote on those bills.
Okay, what I have understood, and I've talked about this with listeners, and I want to make sure that that's still the case, that the Democrats in Congress, who are a half of the House of Representatives, are overwhelmingly in favor of the aid to Ukraine. And Republicans are more evenly split. But still, if you take one half of the total House that is Democratic, and that's all pro-Ukraine, and then you take half of the remaining half, that means is you should be able to get a three-quarters vote of the House of Representatives on behalf of this bill that Speaker Johnson is putting forward. Is that a reasonable expectation?
Yeah, I think that is how that vote could shake out. I mean, you might see a little bit less than half of House Republicans vote for this bill. Overwhelmingly, you're going to see Democrats vote for this bill, but you're going to see it pass the House with essentially flying colors. The issue here is the internal politics within the Republican Party, within his own conference for Speaker Johnson, and that's why this thing is so dicey. It's not a question of whether these bills are going to pass. It's a question of whatever Mike Johnson has to do to get these bills to the floor. Will that cost him his speakership?
Well, it's hard to believe that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie, the Republican from Kentucky, those are the two who have signed on to dump Johnson right now. Is there deeper support for actually removing the speaker than just those two rebels?
The expectation is that there is. They say that there is. Now, there's not a ton of them that have come out publicly and said that. And the reason for that is that, you know, this thing hasn't fully played itself out yet. But if Johnson goes down this path of partnering with Democrats to pass the rule, pass this bill, I would predict that there are going to be a handful of other Republicans in the House who would be willing to move to get rid of Johnson from the speakership. And then that puts Johnson in a position where, again, he's going to need a number of Democrats to vote to save him on the House floor to keep him in his job. And we've seen a couple of Democrats say publicly that they're willing to do that. But the optics and the politics of that for Johnson are just obviously not ideal.
Well, when you say they're not ideal, I mean, if Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, takes the lead and says, no, we think it would be a disaster for the future of the House for Johnson to be removed as Speaker, who would they replace him with, by the way?
That's the question. I mean, Johnson, you have to remember that when former Speaker McCarthy lost his job, they went through Jim Jordan, Tom Emmer, Steve Scalise. They went through three different members who could not get the 218 votes that are needed to become Speaker until they finally settled on Mike Johnson, and that took 3 weeks. And this Republican conference is more fractured than it was at that time. The majority is even more slim. They've lost more members. More members are resigning and leaving Congress early. So the real question is, if there's anybody in the House Republican conference that could get essentially unanimous Republican support to become Speaker.
Yes, that seems kind of hard to imagine, which is why the question of the Democrats and Republicans actually working together on some of the crucial business for the nation is so important, because you could actually have a complete breakdown of a non-functioning House, and dysfunctional households are never an advantage for the people who live in them. Your guess, would Trump come out to support Mike Johnson if it came to push for the show?
Well, he has sort of floated. Mike Johnson did a press conference with the former president in Mar-a-Lago last week, and Trump said that he's doing a great job under tough circumstances. But he also stopped short of telling Marjorie Taylor Greene to sort of stop her efforts to oust Johnson. And look, I mean, we'll have to see, I guess. It depends on what Johnson does with the policy, and if he sort of is aligning with Trump in terms of the policy decisions that he's making and the agenda that he's setting for the House. I think that the public support from the former president last week was encouraging for Johnson, but we both know, everybody knows, that Trump can change his mind on a whim, and then changes his mind quite frequently, and that's hard to predict.
And it will be hard to imagine him finding time from his busy schedule of defending himself from criminal prosecution. Speaking to from Axios, Stephen Newcomb, his recent pieces have been linked at our website at michaelmedved.com. When we come back, the Kennedy family gets together and takes a stand. Well, not all of them. We'll get to that coming up on the MedVet Show.
Thanks for taking my call. You're the most brilliant radio talk host in America today.
The Michael MedVet Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, there was a gathering of the Kennedy family, not all of them, because there's so many people. I mean, you're talking about big families. The Robert F. Kennedy, may he rest in peace, the former attorney general, the former senator from New York, when he was killed, his wife was pregnant with their 11th child. So that is a Catholic family. Not that all Catholic families have 11 children, but the church has been outspoken in pushing the value and the joy and the blessing of large families. In any event, this is a large family, and they virtually all have stepped forward to distance themselves from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is running this independent campaign for president, and a recent average of some 600 polls that were taken around the country show Robert F. Kennedy Jr. getting 11%, which doesn't mean that he would get a single electoral vote. He wouldn't. But it could mean that he has a decisive impact in swing states if he uses that Kennedy name to appeal to nostalgic Democrats and takes those nostalgic Democrats away from Biden. With a substantial number of voters, they say in Axios, telling pollsters they are dissatisfied with both Biden and Trump, it's a majority of Americans. Democrats are increasingly petrified that a Kennedy name on the ballot will throw the election to Trump. A similar fear pervaded the Democratic Party over the potential no-labels unity ticket. That hope died basically at the same time as one of the founders of No Labels, Joe Lieberman, may his memory be a blessing, passed away. But with plans for a No Labels ticket scuttled, there will be no labels ticket. Biden is turning his focus on the scion of the storied Kennedy family. The speech that was given on behalf of the Kennedy relatives was by his sister, Carrie Kennedy, who sounded like this in her impassioned statement. Listen.
When Daddy announced his bid for the presidency in 1968, he talked about the perilous course our country would take under the wrong leadership. And he said, "I feel obliged to do all that I can. I cannot stand aside." We are here because we feel obliged to do all that we can. We cannot stand aside. In this election, no American can stand aside. We must vote.
And then she says in 2024, there are only two candidates with any chance of winning the presidency. We know them well. And she spoke very much and very passionately about the differences between her father's legacy and her uncle's legacy as well. Her uncle, of course, being President John F. Kennedy, and how much they would be horrified at Biden losing to Donald Trump, and especially the idea that he would be losing to Donald Trump because a member of the Kennedy family was taking votes away from Joe Biden. And she says, "I can only imagine how Donald Trump's outrageous lies and behavior would have horrified my father. President Biden has been a champion for all the rights and freedoms that my father and uncle stood for," she said, joined by more than a dozen members of the Kennedy clan who gathered in Philadelphia. Why Philadelphia? Okay, so something we talked about yesterday a little bit. Everything is going to be Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. It's Pennsylvania, which is the absolute most crucial of all the swing states with its 19 electoral votes. And frankly, it is difficult to imagine Joe Biden winning this election if he loses Pennsylvania. And it's also, frankly, it's difficult to imagine Donald Trump winning this election if he loses Pennsylvania. That is where the crucial battle is, which may be why when he was speaking in Pennsylvania, not in Gettysburg, but in Schneckville, President Trump had his mind taken back to the Battle of Gettysburg. Speaking about endorsements, there was this strong endorsement of President Biden by the Kennedy clan. One member of the clan, a cousin who is a Shriver, because one of Robert Kennedy's and John Kennedy's sisters was Eunice Shriver, Eunice Kennedy Shriver. Her daughter, Maria, married Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay, this is all too much family history. But there it was actually something too much in terms of a surprise that was revealed on Fox News with Bill Barr, the former attorney general, who has been unbelievably critical and withering in his criticism of Donald Trump, said he's voting for Trump in 2024. Here's how he expressed it. It's clip four.
I've said from the beginning, this case is an abomination. You know, it's obviously political. 7 years after he pays hush money to try to come up with this case. It's also, as you say, it's not only far-fetched, they're trying to predicate it on a federal crime, which wasn't prosecuted, and they're wrong about it. This was not a campaign contribution. They're just wrong on the law. But to me, this shows that the real threat to liberty, the real threat to our system, are the excesses of the progressive left. They're perverting the system of justice, and you know that's where the danger lies, the corruption and subversion of our institutions by the left. Well, I've said all along, you know, given two bad choices, I think it's my duty to pick the person I think would do the least harm to the country. And in my mind, that's I will vote the Republican ticket.
You
will support the Republican ticket. I think the real danger to the country, the real danger to democracy, as I say, is the progressive agenda. And while Trump, and I said, Trump may be playing Russian roulette, but continuation of the Biden administration is national suicide, in my opinion.
Okay, and this compared to some of the previous statements, which we'll take a listen to, where he warned about the impact of another Trump term. And speaking of some of the warnings, one of the arguments about President Trump, who's preoccupied now with actually maintaining momentum in the ongoing trial, the hush money trial. They had selected seven jurors, but then two of those jurors were dropped because they found out that one of them had second thoughts and one of them had a criminal history of tearing down some conservative posters that had appeared at one point in the 1990s, dropped from the jury. They now have replaced those two jurors with two other jurors. There is been an interview with one of the dismissed jurors who targeted Trump based on his skin color. Is that racist necessarily? We'll get to that and more coming up on the Medved Show.
The greatest show on God's green earth.
It is a horror show.
The Michael Medved Show.
When he's left to his own devices.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved Show, we were just talking about the somewhat surprising news that Bill Barr, who served as Attorney General during the Trump administration, and was horrified and expressed that horror with the Trump attempts to overturn the election of 2020, where he's spoken very directly about what a second Trump term would mean. And one assumed that based upon the very detailed, very specific, very fact-based rejection of President Trump, who had once appointed him as Attorney General, that Bill Barr was either not going to vote or he was going to vote elsewhere, that he certainly wasn't going to vote to put Trump back into power. But he just announced on Fox News that because of the excesses of the left, and particularly of their criminal prosecution of President Trump on various counts, most recently about this hush money trial that's going on, that he was actually going to switch or at least make a decision that he was voting for the Republican ticket. He couldn't quite say, I'm voting for Donald Trump. He said, I'm voting for the Republican ticket. But that includes Donald Trump as the head of the ticket. Here is a flashback of various interviews and speeches that Bill Barr recently has delivered, expressing a very different opinion of Donald Trump. Clip five.
It is a horror show when he's left to his own devices. And so you may want his policies, but Trump will not deliver Trump policies. He will deliver chaos.
He knew that the claims of stolen election were false, and yet he decided he was going to try to stay in office by subverting that process. There was very grave wrongdoing here, and I think it's reasonable to say that it falls within the obstruction of a proceeding.
Our country can't be a therapy session for, you know, a troubled man like this. He is a consummate narcissist. He will always put his own interests and gratifying his own ego ahead of everything else, including the country's interest.
Okay, this is some very strong negativity, I think you would say. And yes, for all these reasons, he's my choice for president of the United States. Really? Really? Well, it's a decision Bill Barr made. Would he have a place in a new Trump administration? Could Trump appoint him, if not to the attorney general position, another cabinet post, or as a White House advisor? I think that's a little bit far-fetched. I think that's deeply, deeply unlikely. There was also this, a dismissed Trump juror seemed to be obsessed with Trump's skin color. Now, this doesn't mean black or white. It means orange or yellow. Okay, this is a dismissed juror. I don't know why she was taken away. She is a recently became a U.S. citizen. And she was not only in the process of making her first ever decision as a U.S. citizen who to vote for, but she was very possibly going to be a candidate for the jury position. She was interviewed by MSNBC after she was rejected, dismissed as a potential juror. Here's her comment.
That is unbelievable.
I know.
What was your impression of Donald Trump when you saw him?
You know, he looked less orange, definitely, like more yellowish, like yellow. Nothing else than that. He looks... he doesn't look angry, or I think he looks bored, like he wants this to finish and go do his stuff.
I think that's probably an accurate summary. He looks bored. He wants to finish and go do his stuff. The question is his stuff worth doing? And again, we live at a very peculiar time where... a brief mention of a possible vice presidential candidacy all of a sudden makes Aaron Rodgers, yes, that Aaron Rodgers, the quarterback, very successfully for the Green Bay Packers, but not so successfully with his move to New York, and not so successfully as a potential running mate for Robert Kennedy Jr., who, by the way, has been endorsed by one of the more distant family members. His cousin, whose name is Anthony Shriver, who is the son of Eunice Shriver Kennedy and Sergeant Shriver, has given an endorsement to Robert Kennedy Jr., says he's with him all the way, which means he's not totally isolated in the extended family, but almost. In any event, he didn't get a chance to choose Aaron Rodgers as his running mate, and maybe based upon the conspiracy theory most recently put forward by Aaron Rodgers in a podcast interview, maybe it's the best idea that he stay clear of politics. Here's what he had to say about one of the most devastating epidemics. It wasn't quite a pandemic in recent American history. This is clip six.
The blueprint, the game plan was made in the 80s. Create a pandemic with a virus that's going wild, right? He was given, Fauci was given like over $350 million to research this, to come up with drugs, new or repurposed, to handle the AIDS pandemic. And all they came up with was AZT. And if you do any, even a smidge of research, and I know I'm not a, you know, epidemiologist, I'm not a doctor, I'm not an immunologist. I can read though, right? And I can learn and look things up just like any normal person. You know, I can do my own research, which was so vilified, you know, yeah, to even question authority. But that was the game plan back then. Create an environment where only one thing works. Back then, AZT. Now, remdesivir until we get a vaccine. Which, by the way, Anthony Fauci had stake in the Moderna vaccine.
Okay, basically he's suggesting that HIV/AIDS was the product of a conspiracy involving Dr. Anthony Fauci, who created the disease and had the help of the U.S. government. Okay, why then would there be such a particular problem? What did the U.S. government have to gain? What did Anthony Fauci have to gain by spreading AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, where it was a devastating disease? And was this all part of a plan for this same government to expend money and to save lives and to basically avert and turn back the terrible AIDS epidemic that struck the country? Or does Aaron Rodgers believe that they created AIDS deliberately to harm or to damage the gay population, which was uniquely and even more horribly impacted than any other segment of the population? Again, the fact that people can talk this way, leading people, other people, and the public, and anyone who listens to avoid getting vaccines that can save your life. And the difficulty with people like Aaron Rodgers, and yes, like Robert Kennedy Jr., is it's not just a question about the COVID-19 vaccinations, which have also worked incredibly well and have brought us to this position where we no longer have a rampaging pandemic. It's one of those things I was noting. I went to a screening the other night of one of those movies we're going to talk about tomorrow. It's a movie called The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. And we'll get to that. But at the screening, I was noticing there were maybe two people who were wearing face masks. I mean, we've made progress regarding the pandemic. President Biden told Israel, take the win. We should take the win when it's available and it can actually save people's lives on this issue of vaccines. We will get to more on the issue of Iran and Israel coming up in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
Here's a special discount, 50% off just for being a MedHead annual member. Join today at michaelmedved.com.